Good afternoon, or morning. This is the morning class. So last time, we started by finishing up covering object files and linking. We mentioned things that the object file contains that needed to be in there to represent the assembly file faithfully, namely relocations, this idea that we had these placeholders where we didn't know where something would end up in the executable. We wanted to have that filled in when we made the executable. So, for example, our jump instruction know where to jump to, or call instruction knew what to call, or our move instruction knew an address to place into a register. And also symbol tables, which is when another object file references a function, for example. We want it to be able to figure out where that is when the linker is working. The linker's not going to go all the way back to the assembly to do that. So we need to write down the information about where the code for that function or the bytes for a particular constant ended up in the object file based on the name that appears in the assembly. So we can use that later. Then we went on to talking a bit about assembly. We went over AT&T syntax, just how to translate from Intel syntax to AT&T syntax, a few things that you might not have seen in Intel syntax, like computed jumps where the target is a register or a memory address that's not a constant or label. We talked a little about LEA, about how x86-64 clears registers when you're writing to 32-bit and not 16-bit. Reviewed the calling convention extremely briefly. Reminded you that you can look that up when you need to know it, and you should. And we started by looking at converting if to assembly, just the practice of, reviewed a little in 2150 with IBCM, of you have some C-like code, how do you actually write that in assembly? And the method we were talking about was starting with this notion of if go to C as sort of middle ground, and then that translated straight to assembly. So before I pick up there, any questions on any of the things from last time other than that? Other than if to assembly? Okay, so last time we were talking about converting something like this to assembly. So the procedure I recommend is first write it as this if go to form with labels. So adding this go to Z, and when you do this, we end up with something where each line is very straightforward to translate to assembly, if you remember how conditional jump instructions work, or we'll review that. So we just translate this directly to a compare and conditional jump. We translate this go to directly into a jump, and so on. And everything else translates basically one for one to the assembly instruction that does that arithmetic. And we can use the same procedure for something like a loop. So I'll start with a do while loop because that's the simplest one. And I write something like this. We just have an if that goes to the beginning of the loop. And again, we can translate that line by line back to assembly. We have this if go to ends up being compare jump. So any questions about this? Okay, so we're going to some conditional jumps. So I want to talk a bit about how conditional jumps actually work. So typically when it's been taught in 2150, usually the idea is that we say you have this special compare instruction. And maybe if you're lucky, they mention the test instruction, which is like compare. We'll talk about it in a sec. And the notion is that that kind of pairs with this conditional jump instruction, like jump greater than. But that's not quite how it works. So the conditional jump instructions read these things called condition codes, which you can think of as sort of special registers. They aren't like normal registers. They don't hold just an arbitrary number. But they're registers that are set by almost all arithmetic instructions. And you might say, what, compare is an arithmetic instruction for this purpose? Yes. And they store information about the last result of arithmetic. And this is what the conditional jump instructions use. So they read the condition codes, and their names are based on interpreting the result of subtraction. So it happens that what the compare instruction's actually doing is a subtraction, but it's just not storing the result anywhere. All it's doing is modifying these condition codes based on the result it computes. So it computes a result, sets these condition codes for the conditional jump instructions, and stops. But if you did a normal subtract instruction, it will set the condition codes the same way and also write the result somewhere. But the idea is that based on that result, these instructions work. So for example, jump greater than is checking whether the result of the last arithmetic operation was positive. If that's subtraction, that means the thing you were subtracting from was greater, which is what we expect for a comparison. So this means, for example, that we can take something like this. So here I'm putting negative 10 in REX, 20 in RBX. I'm subtracting negative 10 from 20, so I get 30. And if I do a jump less than or equal, that's not going to be taken because 30 is greater than 0, which is not the way our jump instructions are named. The way I like remembering it is you can think of jump less than as being less than zero results. Jump less than equal, less than or equal to zero results. And 30 is greater than zero, so it's not going to be less than or less than equal. Okay. And this is even though I never used a compare instruction here. So any questions on what happens here? Yeah. So the question is, what registers are the condition codes stored in? So the condition codes are special registers.
Is one of the 16?
So the question is it one of the 16 registers? No, it isn't a special additional register you haven't learned about yet until you're learning about now.
So this is like less than or equal to, it's always like combined to zero? Or?
So the names of the instructions are based on comparing to zero. So as we'll see, the condition codes are just a few bits, and it's interpreting those bits. So there might be other arithmetic instructions that set them in a less intuitive way, which we mostly won't talk about. But like that's what it's based on. But the easiest way to remember it is comparing to zero. Yes. So compare to subtraction. So there's also a test instruction. Who's seen the test instruction before? A few people. So the test instruction is like, compare does a subtraction, the test instruction does a bitwise and does the same thing. You typically see the test instruction used where it is test REX REX. So this is going to have the same effect as doing compare 0 REX almost because the result we compute is the same. We'll talk about bitwise end later, but REX ended with REX is always REX, and compare 0 and REX is REX minus 0, we get REX, so they're basically the same. So this is why we typically see, so this is what you're typically used to, is that you do a compare instruction, and this is going to have the same effect as if we did a subtract instruction here, but it doesn't set RBX. That's the only difference between the two instructions. So the compare instruction you're used to is just a subtract, except it forgets to write the results, but it sets these special condition codes, which are used by the conditional jump instructions. So questions about that? Okay. So here I have our do while again. And there's something we can do here based on what we just talked about. So right here, this is computing R12 minus 0 and setting the condition codes based on that. And the instruction before it is computing an R12 from R12 minus 1, and also setting the condition codes. And this is setting the condition codes. So we can actually omit the compare instruction, because the compare instruction setting the condition codes based on the current value of R12, the subtract instruction is setting the condition codes based on the same results, the same number. So here I just do that, and it's the same loop. And when you look at assembly like in our bomb homework, you might see the compiler do this. The compiler knows about this trick. It knows that subtract sets the condition codes this way, and it's going to take advantage of that. It's not going to compare to zero. It's just going to say, oh, I already have that result in the condition codes. I can get rid of an instruction. That's better. I'm just going to do that. And you'll often see the compiler write loops in that sort of way. And this gives you the logic for having this condition code system, is that there's a lot of loops where you can not have a separate compare instruction. You can just do the subtraction you'd be doing anyways, or the addition, or whatever arithmetic operation you do anyways, and you could use a conditional dumb instruction alone, and it would just be able to do what you want, because you happen to be decrementing something to zero, or making something positive or negative anyways. So that's the rationale that the x86 designers had for using this system, rather than only having these condition codes set by explicit compare instructions. Okay. So I've only shown this with subtract and compare so far, but the same way it also works with, for example, other instructions like add. So here I'm adding 20 and negative 20, I get 0. 0 is equal to 0, so jump equal will be taken. So we set the condition codes based on the result 0. 0 is equal to 0. That's the way I remember that jump equal will say yes to that. Okay, so questions so far? Yeah. The question is, does the move command set the condition codes? And the answer is no. So instructions that compute something mostly set the condition codes. There's a few instructions, two of them. We talked about compare and subtract, compare and test, which only set the condition codes, which are basically the same as some instruction that writes something to a register, but without doing the write part, but they do the computation. And there's a few instructions that don't. So the most obvious one is move. Well, it doesn't compute anything, so it makes sense that it's not arithmetic to set the condition codes based on what I've told you. And jump, call, conditional jumps, return. Those also don't compute anything. That makes sense. The less obvious one is that LEA doesn't, even though we've seen LEA used to compute things. And this is just a choice that x86 made. It's not like there's, you know, something which says this has to set the condition codes and this doesn't. The way you find out for sure if it sets the condition codes is you take Intel's manual and you open it up to the instruction and find out it's going to be written down. Does this set condition codes and how does it do it? But for the most part, these are the important exceptions. So that, yeah.
Wait, doesn't the arithmetic happen in LEA?
So the arithmetic happens in LEA the same time it happens in the other instructions. It just doesn't change the condition codes. Is that clear? It's just like an exception to the rule. The rationale behind it is that LEA is doing an address computation, and we don't think of address computations as arithmetic instructions, as I think.
Where does that calculations happen?
What?
Where does that like addition or multiplication calculations happen specifically?
So the question is, where does LEA's calculations happen? Probably the same place a normal addition and shift and multiplication would happen. Okay, so this means that if we have code like this, here I compute 0, I set the condition codes based on the result to 0. It doesn't matter if I do a move instruction after that, the condition codes are the same. So because we have these special condition code registers, This means that we can do stuff that doesn't change them in between and break this pattern that you've always seen of having something which sets up our conditional jump just before the conditional jump. Should you write assembly like this? Probably not. But this is how it works. Okay. So questions? Okay, so I've talked about the condition codes representing the last result. And the representation you might have in mind, therefore, is that the condition codes are just another 64-bit register with the result, and we check that every time. That's not, in fact, what x86 does in most processors that implement something like this. X86 just has a couple of bits telling us the important things about the result, like was it zero? So I'm going to start by talking about a subset of these bits, the two most important ones for this class. So one is called the zero flag. So one bit of the condition code is, was the result of the last arithmetic that set condition codes zero? And this is what maps to equal when we think of the jump instructions. Another one is the sign flag. Was the result negative? Which you can think of as, was the sign bit set? So rather than storing the full result, we only need to store two bits so far. There's actually a few extra things we need to handle overflow, and I'll talk about that later. And you can in fact see these in GDB. So in GDB, if you type info registers, you'll see an eFlags register. And it will show you, sometimes it will show you ZF or SF. That means that those bits are set. They're part of, that's how the register that the condition codes are part of that GDB will show you. Yeah?
Is there a way to manually set the value of the condition
codes? So the question is there a way to manually set the value of the condition codes? Yes. There are instructions for doing that because x86, if you can think of something, it often has an instruction to do it. There are also instructions to dump the values of the condition code somewhere, which is important for operating systems, for example, which need to save the state of a running program. Okay. Other questions? Okay. So to be concrete, so here we have my code, which computes 30, that's the result I get. So what are the values of ZF and SF? I'll give you 30 seconds. I'll write. ZF, remember, is 0, and SF is sign. Someone want to tell me what those two flags are? They're Boolean, so they're 0 or 1. Yeah. What? They're both 0. Okay. Yeah. And the way I figured this out is the 0 flag is true if it's 0. The answer is not 0, which we interpret as they're not equal. The things we subtracted weren't equal or compared weren't equal. And the sign flag, the result was not negative. The sign bit was 0, so the result is 0. Okay. And we can do something similar for this. So for example, here I get 0. 0 is not negative, so it's still SF equals 0, but it is 0, so the 0 flag is going to be true. And if we think about our example where we set move before, the result was 0 here, and at this point, we set SF equals 0, ZF equals 1, and this didn't change, this next instruction didn't change the condition codes, so when we did this jump, we had SF equals 0, ZF equals 1, and this was asking equal to 0, which is the same as the 0 flag was equal to 1. And it checked the 0 flag was equal to 1, that's why the jump is taken. Not because it looked back at what the actual instruction was, it just checked that one bit to figure out, yes, I need to go to the label foo. It's implying it's looking at RBX. You can think of it that way, but that breaks down if you think of, I could do like move into RBX and we'd have the same results. So like the actual thing that said the condition codes doesn't need to exist anywhere anymore, as long as we don't change them with other instructions. Yeah.
If an instruction doesn't change one of the condition codes, does it clear the others, or does it?
If an instruction doesn't change one of the condition codes, does it clear the others? I'm not sure, and it might vary between instructions. Generally, the normal arithmetic instructions just set, for our purposes, all of the condition codes. I know there's some exceptions for some bitwise instructions, but I'm not sure exactly how that works. So let's try another exercise. You 30 seconds to go. Went to 0 and the sign flag again. Someone want to have an answer to repose or a question? No volunteers. So we have this, so we move negative 1 into REX, we add negative 2, we get negative 3. And I pointed out that, well, these are actually going to be the same instructions as if we moved this giant positive unsigned number into REX, and a giant positive unsigned number added a giant positive unsigned number to REX. So the question is, how are the condition codes set? So they're always going to be set based on ZF and SF, are always set up based on the actual result with it interpreted as a signed number, because sign flag means we have a sign bit. So we're going to look at just this sign result to figure out if it's negative. We wouldn't look at the unsigned result to figure out if it's negative, because that's not going to give us any information. And we'll find out, well, it's not 0, and it is negative. So you might say, well, what do we do about this overflow? Don't we want to do something about that at least sometimes? Like if I'm comparing to unsigned numbers, or I'm dealing with unsigned numbers, I want a way of dealing with that. And the way we're going to deal with that in the processor is that we actually have a couple extra bits in our condition codes. So there's 2 extra bits. So there's an overflow flag, which is, did the computation overflow or underflow as signed? As in, did we get the wrong result if we interpret it as a sign, if we interpret the operands as a signed number? and the result is a signed number? Did we get the result of the wrong, like did we add two negative numbers together and get a positive number, then the overflow flag should be set, or we added two positive numbers together and got a negative number, the overflow flag should be set, because that's not the right answer for as a signed number. And the carry flag is the same idea, but interpreting things as unsigned. Did we add two numbers together and get something that was smaller than either of them? You know, then the carry flag should be set. Another way of thinking about it and where the name comes from is for addition, the question is just, did we have a 64th place bit that we wanted to have that was one or not? That's what the carry flag is. So this is how the processor remembers for this that overflow happened. And the question is, when do we use that information? How do we use that information? And the answer is that x86 has made a choice to have two sets of those conditional jump instructions. So we have things like jump less than equal, jump greater than, and these are signed conditional jumps. And that means they check the sign flag and also the overflow flag. So they look at the sign flag and they check the overflow flag to see if the sign flag is wrong. And this is what we'll be dealing with for most of this class. x86 also has a carry flag, which it uses with some unsigned instructions. So there's JA for jump above and JB for jump below. And jump below, for example, checks the carry flag to see if we did a subtraction and we got a negative number, would have gotten a negative number if we could represent it because we got the wrong answer. So that's what jump below and jump above are going to check. So which ones are used depends on that, but we don't actually change the computation we're doing based on whether the operands are signed or unsigned. So when the compiler is generating code, it figures out which of these to use based on whether used a signed int or an unsigned int. But the add instructions and so on are all the same, regardless of whether you care about the result as an unsigned number or a signed number. So questions about this? Okay, so some notes on this in this class. So we have an assignment to implement a processor, and the version of that in our textbook does only these condition codes. They decided to keep things simpler, we're gonna get rid of the unsigned conditional jump instructions just to, because you can do everything you want without them. It's just, you know, it's harder to translate some C code if you don't have them. And we're gonna simplify things further by only using ZF and SF. We're just gonna say, okay, yes, we know this doesn't handle overflow correctly. We're just going to say that we're going to implement a processor which doesn't handle overflow for comparisons correctly. And be okay with that because it's a course assignment and it's not hard to do that, but it's not really one of the key concepts we're trying to get across in this class. Question?
Can we say 1 month when there's overflow with only using ZF and SF?
Can I say what?
Can we say like 1, 1 is 0 and negative when there's an overflow, to indicate an overflow?
Can we say it's 0 and negative? So the question is, can we say it's 0 and negative? So we can't really do that because we want to properly indicate which kind of overflow was it. So for example, for jump less than, what we want to do is that if SF is 1 and OF is 0, then it was actually less. But if SF is 1 and OF is 1, then it was actually greater. And if SF is 0 and OF is 1, it was actually less. And we want to distinguish between these two overflow situations. The case where it overflowed, but the correct result would have been positive versus negative. So that's why we can't do something like reuse the zero flag for it. Yeah. So the question is, how do we know if something's unsigned?
Yeah, like, what does it look like?
So if you're reading assembly, we don't. The question is interpreting the result as signed or unsigned. Because we have 64 bits, we can always interpret that as a signed int or an unsigned int. And basically, the processor is going to have hardware which is going to check the signed result and the unsigned result simultaneously for everything. Yeah?
So does overflow always just flip the answer like that?
What?
Does overflow always just flip the answer like that?
Essentially, yeah. For sign, it's more complicated for something like multiply or divide. So we can think about this. So if you go back to this example, remember we have a result of 30. And if we treat this as unsigned, it's in fact an overflow, because we're adding, subtracting a giant number from 20, and we get a positive number rather than a negative number, because we can't represent a negative number. So if we do this, the carry flag's going to be true, the overflow flag's going to be zero, because of the result we got. And on the x86 processor, this means that for jump less than, jump greater than, they're just going to look at these, including the overflow flag, the sign flag, and the zero flag, and they're going to say, well, the overflow flag's zero, I'm just using the sign and zero flag like you'd expect. When we do something like jump above, it's going to look at the carry flag and say, oh, the result is not correct, I need to flip my logic a bit. And because we're not implementing it, I'm not going to go into much more detail about this. This is just enough to, like, so you can figure it out when you need it, because we won't be having you implement it. And as I said, it's not, like, I don't think implementing it is that useful an exercise relative to other parts of the processor we care about. Okay, and we have the same sort of thing for other negative results and so on. Okay, so now that we've gone over condition codes, let's look back at loops to assembly. So here's a loop, and I want to translate it to assembly. I started with a do while loop, and a while loop is going to be different. And this is the difference is important, and a mistake a lot of people make when translating loops like this to assembly. The big thing is we better check the value of x before we call foo. We can't call foo without having checked whether x started as like -1. And it's common to not do that because, well, you think they probably wouldn't have written this loop if they don't expect it to be executed at least once, but that's not what the C code says. So this is our typical pattern here. I have a check at the beginning of the loop. If x is less than 0, to skip the loop, and then I call foo, decrement x, go back to the beginning. And we can translate this line by line again to our assembly. So this is one way of doing things. So could we do this? Is there a better way of doing this? There's something that might be an improvement.
Yeah. Can you do the first test before the loop starts?
Yeah, so one thing we could do is we could say that we're going to have the if x less than 0 go to end loop. Then we're going to have start loop, then foo, then x minus minus, then an if go to start. Basically, as you said, translating this to a do while loop. And the advantage of this is now our loop here has less instructions. And this is something that compilers, which have good heuristics for removing single instructions from loops, will do. So, with that idea in mind, which is the, which of these are correct translations of this loop? So we've demonstrated that there are multiple ways of writing a while loop, and there's reasons you might want to use the possibly more complicated ones. Like the one you were proposing had two comparisons. So which of these are translations? I'll give you a minute. So, who needs more time? No volunteers. So, okay.
First one, executive spoon.
Sorry, the first one. Yes. So this is a do while. So this is. Can't be right.
The last one, that was the opposite, like checks if b is greater than or equal to 10.
So the last one, you say it's checking if b is greater than or equal to 10. So let's think about this carefully. So rax is 10. So what's the subtract instruction computing? And this is tricky thing, especially because we just learned about AT&T syntax. So this is computing 10 minus b.
Oh yes, sorry.
And yes, that is tricky. And we're asking, is 10 minus b greater than or equal to 0? So we're asking if minus b is greater than or equal to minus 10, or plus b is less than or equal to 10, and we have a problem with the equal part.
And B is the integer.
What?
B is the integer.
And so B, I believe, is, yeah, problem with the equal part in the direction, I think. So, and B, we compare 10, yeah, so here we compute RBX minus 10. We're asking whether that's greater than or equal to 0, so we're asking if RBX is greater than or equal to 10. Which is going to be b x set. So we can think of this as until b is greater than or equal to 10, and that's what we want to check. So here we have the wrong direction of comparison, because that should be less than given the subtraction we're doing. Here it's fine. Okay. Questions on this? Yeah.
Can you explain the whole thing with B and why it's that?
Why it's, so remember the compare instruction is the same as a subtract, the same subtract instruction, but we just discard the result. So this is subtract 10 from RBX. So that's RBX minus 10, is how we set our condition codes. So this is asking, this greater than equal is asking, is RBX minus 10 greater than or equal to 0? And I just did algebra on that. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
Is there any reason, I know that version C is still wrong, but is there any reason why you set R at X equal to 10? We could have just done sub Q plus 10.
So the question is, why didn't I do sub Q constant of 10?
Just 10, right? Instead of the bare, instead of the register that
you wanted to do this?
Yeah, is that possible?
That doesn't use RBX at all.
Oh, then in that case, RBX comma 10.
Yeah, so you want to do this. So, and if you do this, this instruction, this version of the subtract instruction doesn't exist.
Okay.
That's why I didn't do that. It mainly doesn't exist because you're asking to store the results in a constant, but it turns out that that version of the compare instruction also doesn't exist if you wanted to do a compare instead of a subtract. Okay, other questions? Okay, so we had multiple options. So I did mention that there were multiple options, and we discovered like you could move the comparison outside. And in fact, you know, we have here our straightforward code, and we have the version where the comparison is moved outside to save an instruction in the loop, and we just do the test in the loop. And compilers will actually do this. So like this is basically the assembly I got by setting the optimization level appropriately with a compiler. And compilers will sometimes do even more clever things, like this. Someone tell me, why did the compiler generate version 3 instead of version 2? What was the compiler thinking that made that a good idea? What's the advantage? And I'm asserting that it has the same effect. I know that is not clear. But why would the compiler, like, what's the advantage of version 3 over version 2? Yeah?
Well, there's only 4 instructions in the loop for version 3, but there's 5 in loop version 1.
So they say there's only 4 in the loop in version 3. It's actually less than that. There's 3 in the loop. Versus 4 here, and 5 in version 1. Yeah, but that is the savings. The compiler has managed to save an instruction in the loop, and to do that, instead of storing B in RBX, the compiler did a transformation RBX contains 10 minus B. I believe it's 10 minus B or B. Yeah, 10 minus B so that it can use JNE, so it can use decrement and JNE to end the loop rather than comparing to 10. So the work the compiler is doing is it's instead of having storing B, it's storing something which will become 0 when we're done with the loop. And it did that transformation all to save one instruction, which is faster, assuming we do that loop enough. It's maybe faster. I'm saying maybe, we'll learn later on in the semester that there's good reasons to be skeptical that for this particular case, it's actually faster, but that's why the compiler is doing that. Okay, any questions on this? Okay, so other than that, one last note on assembly. I mentioned computed jumps last time. I'd like to show you the most common pattern you might see them in when doing something like the homework, which is that if you have a table like this, we have our computed jump. Remember, this is an offset. So this is memory at the offset, which is the table, plus RAX times 8. And what compilers will commonly do for something like a switch statement is they'll make a table with every case, with just a list of pointers to the code for each case, which I've marked with dot quad for a 64-bit constant. And then they'll do this jump instruction, which reads this address here to figure out what to do. And they'll have some code around it to make sure they don't go outside the table. Questions on this? OK, so that's my last bit of talking about assembly then, unless there are more questions on assembly. We'll move one layer up to talking about C and not just translating C to assembly. So C, I'm just reviewing things that you hopefully heard vaguely in 2150 in some form. So the size of C data types varies between machines. For this course, we're using 64-bit Linux. So these are going to be our sizes. Charts are 1 byte, shorts are 2 bytes, ints are 4 bytes, longs are 8 bytes, floats and doubles are 4 and 8 bytes respectively, and any type of pointer is going to be 8 bytes, just on the machines we're using. C doesn't actually require this. This is just how things are. This is the same as in C++. One thing which isn't the same as in C++ is that you're probably used to having a Boolean type. From C++ is called bool. In Java, you may have had this type called Boolean. In C, this basically doesn't exist. The real story is more complicated, but for the most part, there is no Boolean type. And you might say, well, what does that mean, the result of something like x equals 4? That is an int. It is 1 if true, 0 if false, but the result has type int. If you ask what the size of it is, you'll get the size of an int. So, and another thing is that you know that you use this in, for example, if x equals 4. So what does, you know, if expect here? What's a true or false value? And how does it interpret things that they aren't one of these equals operators? And the rule in C is that 0 is false. And this includes null pointers. Null pointers you can think of as 0 cast to a pointer. Every other value is true. So this means, for example, -1 is true, even though you might not want it to be all the time, because it's not 0 and not a null pointer. OK, any questions on this? Yeah. The question, is this more efficient than using your bool? Is it more efficient? It's probably about the same. I think probably you get the same code most of the time, that if C had a Boolean type like Java did. Okay, so another thing, since we're talking about true and false, so I'd like to talk about how the OR operator works. And this is the same as in C++ and Java, but often people have not seen this before, and I don't want you to be surprised. And also, I'd like to talk briefly about what the assembly for this looks like. So here, I have 0 or 1, and this calls 0. So it calls 0 first and prints out 0. Then it calls 1 and prints out 1. And then it prints out the integer, because remember, when you do something like equals, you get an int. So we're printing out that integer with printf, and the result we get printed out is 1. So that makes sense. Then we have the second line. We run 1, we print out 1, and then we don't run 0. There's no second 0 printed out. That's not a typo on the slide. It won't happen. And that's how things work. In the case where we have 0 on the left side, we see that there's 0, and we don't know whether the result of the OR is going to be true or not. So we have to keep going and look for the right side. But in the case where we call 1 first, we look at this truth table, and we find out, oh, I know it's true already. And the compiler generates code which just says, well, I already know it's true, I don't need to call zero. And it doesn't. And you might think, well, this is an optimization. You know, compiler doesn't really have to do that. That's not true. In the C++ and C standards and Java standard, it says the compiler has to work this way. This is not an optimization. This is how the OR and the, as we'll see, the AND operators work. They're not what is known as short circuiting. They go left to right, that's required. And if we don't need any more information to get our result, they stop. Even when there's side effects like here of printing things out. So, does that make sense? And this means that the code for OR and AND is actually probably going to involve like conditional jumps, just like an if statement, rather than, as you might have otherwise guessed, like the AND and OR operators are actually not that likely choice for the compiler to generate. And the same thing is true with AND. So here I have 0 ANDed with 1. I look at 0 and I say, oh, I already know the result's false. I don't need to move on. And the compiler, in fact, generates code which we'll never call 1 because we don't need it. Okay, questions on this? Okay. In the other case, we call 1. We still need more information to know whether the result is true or false. Okay, so that's short-circuiting. Now to what's usually the trickier parts of C and C++, and let's talk about pointers. Starting with strings. So strings in C are pointers. So if I have a string constant here, I usually often have it declared as a pointer. In this case, I have hello, which is a pointer value, so it's an 8-byte value that contains the address of the string data as a sequence of characters terminated with the 0 character. So this is a pointer, and in this case, the way this works is that this is going to be a pointer to read-only data. So it's going to be part of the application that's like hard-coded in the executable, loaded once, and you're not supposed to change that string. You need to make a copy like on the stack or on the heap if you want to do that. You're not supposed to change it because, for example, if you use hello world multiple times in the program, it probably points to the same place. Okay, so this makes sense. Okay, so we're used to pointers like this. And on pointers in C, you can do arithmetic. So I can add 0 to a pointer and nothing happens, just like adding 0 to an integer. And I can add 5 to a pointer, and it advances it by 5 elements. So in the case of strings, it advances it by 5 bytes. So if we have a pointer to this capital H here, advance it by 5, we get a pointer to the space. And we can dereference that to get the character at that location. And there's a shorthand for this that you've probably used more often, which is the array subscript syntax. That is exactly equivalent. And in C, in fact, it is exactly the same in C. In C++, there might be a few exceptions. In C, exactly the same always, no matter what the type of foo and bar are. Questions on this? Okay, so I've shown this for you for arrays of characters. And we know characters are 1 byte, and this makes a lot of sense for 1 byte because when I added 5 to my hello pointer, I just added 5 to the number that represents the pointer. It's the code that was generated for hello plus 5 was, you know, adding literally an add five instruction, you can think of it as. But the same rule applies, and this equivalence applies, even for things that aren't bytes. So here I have an array of ints. Ints are going to be 4 bytes. And I get a pointer, and I set the pointer to the array. This is going to be the same as pointer points to the first element of the array, which has index 0. Those are equivalent. And I can use that to set it. And I can add 2 to the pointer. And that doesn't advance by 2 bytes. It advances by 2 elements. And the elements are ints because we have an int pointer, because I declared it as an int star. And so the compiler is going to generate code which adds 8 if it's generating code for that. So questions on this? So let's, we've gone a little over pointers. Let's do an exercise which doesn't deal with that special case. So here I declare an array of characters. I initialize it to foo, the string foo. Since I made an array, this array is going to be on the stack. It's not going to be a pointer to read-only data. I'm going to have a copy of foo. So with that in mind, I'll give you a minute or so, figure out and check with your neighbor what you think the final value of foo is. Who needs more time? Okay, so who thinks A, B, C, D, E? Okay, so most people agree that it's C. That's what I think the answer is. I'll go briefly over what happens. So first we set pointer to point to the F in foo. Then we use the pointer to change that to a B. Then we advance the pointer 2 elements forward, so it points to the second O. Then we add 0 to that, So we get the same pointer, use that to change that to a Z, and usually I recommend writing that as star pointer equals rather than pointer zero, but they're the same. And then we use foo, we add one, so we get a pointer to the second element of foo, and you reference that to set it to A. Usually I'd write that as foo subscript one equals A, and that's how we get our answer. So any questions on this here? Yeah. So last two steps. So here, this is the same as star pointer plus zero equals Z. So first I'm computing pointer plus zero, but adding zero doesn't do anything. So I have my pointer, which points to this, what was previously O, and I'm just setting it to Z. Make sense? That step. And for the next step, I'm taking foo plus one, which is going to be a pointer to the first element of foo, which is this B, add one, which means I go to the next element. So I have that pointer to what was previously O, and I'm dereferencing it and setting it to A. Okay, back there. So the question is, if I did pointer of one equals Z, would I get BAZZ? I would, because it was previously O, I would get, at this point I would have this, but it wouldn't be, and no null termination. So it would not be quite that. So I'd have a Z at the end, but I'd have no null terminator, which I purposely avoided. Yeah.
So would that return like an error then?
So the question is, would it return like an error? So not have, so for a character array, as long as I'm not looking for a null terminator, it's perfectly fine for everything to be set in it and not have a null at the end. Now, if I actually went to like pass it to printf and print it as a string, I'm going to have some, I might have some problems. But as long as I'm only like checking individual characters, I can store whatever I want in the character array, including no null bytes or null bytes. Just like I can store, just like I, in its array, I don't have to have a zero at the end of that. Same principle. Other questions? Okay, so we've seen these operators. So a brief note on precedence. Sometimes you'll see people do things that you might want to use more parentheses for, and you might not guess properly what C has decided the precedence is. So ampersand foo of one is the same as finding the first element of foo plus one, you know, star foo plus one, and dereferencing that. It's not the same as taking a pointer to foo and then using that like an array as an array subscript. So that makes sense. That's what you probably remember from 2150, whenever you've had to get a pointer to an element of an array or a vector. The same rule applies for something like this. Star foo of zero is getting foo at index zero. So, and dereferencing that, it's not the other way around. Not the other way around. So this is something which comes up a bit on one of our homeworks, which is why I'm mentioning it. So if you want to do star foo of 100, you need to have the parentheses because that has a very different result if you don't put with the parentheses or without. So make sure you choose which one you're doing, and when in doubt, you can always add parentheses. Like, you can write this. It's fine. You know, if you don't remember, add parentheses. Also, sometimes you'll see code which does star foo plus plus, and many of you would probably guess, oh, that dereferences foo and increments the thing that it dereferenced, and that's not what it does. It increments the pointer and dereferences the result of the increment. And I don't recommend writing code like this, but it's not uncommon that you'll see C code which takes advantage of this. And as I said, if in doubt, you can always you can always write extra parentheses, so you can write this version or this version. And I would recommend doing so. Questions? Miss? And as with all precedence things, don't memorize it, just use parentheses. Yeah?
So do the star and ampersand have the lowest precedence in any computational method?
The star and ampersand have the lowest precedence. I don't remember my low high precedence. I think so for purpose. I'm only giving these specific examples because I checked how they work. I don't actually have my C precedence table memorized. Because when I don't remember it, I just use parentheses and that works for me. Okay, so from what we've seen here, we've had this equivalence between pointers and arrays, and you might say, well, arrays and pointers are the same thing. And this is often sort of what we say in 2150, but it's not true. So we have a pointer here. I can assign a pointer to the array, which is the same as getting a pointer to the first element. The other way around is illegal. Can't do it. Legal in the sense it won't compile. So that's one important difference. The array has memory associated with it. You can't change where that memory is. It's located there, in this case, probably on the stack. And you can't reassign it. There's some other differences. So if I ask for the size of an array with the size of operator, I get the number of bytes in the array. If I ask for the size of a pointer, I get the number of bytes in the pointer, which is the size of an address. And this is regardless of what the pointer points to. The size of operator doesn't check the value you're passing, it just checks its type. Another way of thinking about it is the size of operator is 100% compile time as far as we're concerned. So it can't look at like what happened before to figure it out. It just looks at the type it was declared with. So what about this? And what tell me, what is the size of ampersand array 0? Yeah, back there. 8, why 8?
It's just a pointer
to the first element, right? Yeah, so when we do ampersand array 0, the compiler, when we do that, forgets that it's an array anymore and just remembers that it's a pointer. So we're asking how big is a pointer? It's 8 bytes. On this system. Okay. Any questions about this? Okay. So, now for a brief interlude on command line things you probably should know, but might not. So, there is a utility that exists in the Linux command line that is very useful that I would like to teach you about, and that's the man utility, which stands for manual pages. So there's a manual for all your command line commands and also for C library functions. And you might say, well, how do I use this? Well, happily, the manual pages have a manual page, so we can ask for that. And we find out this manual page, man, an interface to the online reference manuals. And we have all the possible ways I could run this command. You have a description, and perhaps most usefully, we have this example section, which shows us sort of examples of commands we might run. We see that we can display a manual page for a particular program. We can ask for a particular section, whatever that is. We can ask for all the manual pages with a particular name, and so on. So I want you to let you know about this, because if you want to know, for example, what options does LS take, this will tell you that. What options does GCC take? This is a place to start looking. And often it's helpful, like you often won't want to read the whole manual page, like you might say, well, this is an awful lot of text that I don't care about over here, but there's often an example section, and I would recommend looking for that sort of thing as a first like glance at a manual page. So there's some other commands that you may or may not have used previously. So one of them is chmod. So let's look up the manual page for chmod. So chmod stands for change file mode bits. You might wonder, why am I talking about file mode bits? What are they? So these importantly determine permissions. And unfortunately, this manual page doesn't really have examples. But these determine permissions. And most notably, as described here, they determine whether you can read, write, or execute things. So this is useful, first of all, if you want to make sure that people aren't reading your home directory on the department machine. So this command, for example, recursive, if you look that up in the manual page, it says that applies to not just home user, but all the files contained within it. Then we have this funny code here. And if we decode it by reading the manual page carefully, but I'll give you a summary, we have others and group, and the group is typically student on the department machines, and minus for remove, read permission. So that might be a useful command if that's not the default, which historically it hasn't been. I don't know if they fixed that. The other big reason I'm mentioning this is because one of the permissions is execute. So something you can sometimes do is you'll sometimes transfer files, like including the bomb, for example, and you want to execute the bomb, and you find out you can't execute it, you get a permission denied. This is how you fix that. You can mark it as executable by saying you, something like you plus X, you for user, add execute permission. This is also, so it's useful for that, in addition to making sure other people can't read your files, or making it so they can read your files if that's something you're intentionally trying to do. Okay, so questions about this? But like most, probably the most notable case where it comes up as a blocking issue is if you transfer files and you find out there's an executable in there and it's not executable anymore. How do I fix that? This is how you fix that. There's also a utility tar, which we use a bunch. Sometimes we'll have you download a bunch of files for a homework or a lab assignment, and you need to extract them. And we'll typically give them to you as a tar archive. So tar stands for tape archive. We probably don't use tapes for this anymore, but that's where the name comes from. And the important commands are, you have this table of contents, and you always specify an F for file, because the default is tape. So TF is table of contents of a file, and you specify the file. That gives you a list. X for extract, C for create. And I often use the V option for verbose. If you don't use the V option, when it extracts, it's just going to create a bunch of files and not tell you what it did. You just have to like type LS and guess which files are new. So I like using V to figure that out. So any questions on this?
Wait, so I said verbose does what?
Verbose lists the files that are being extracted or added to the archive. Otherwise, it's going to do the same thing but not tell you about it. Okay, so one last, one important command line thing. So often I see people, in my lab, they're doing something, they're writing commands, and I see them do something like, write a command like this, and then they just start retyping it. And you don't have to do that. So there's, if you press the up arrow, you can do line editing with the arrow keys, and you can fix your bad command. Also, there is a feature known as tab completion. So if I type cd space spe and type a tab, it gives me, completes part of the file name based on what's there. If I type tab twice, it will show me the options if it's ambiguous. And I can keep doing that. So if I type CS3, this is the only course that's that, and I type tab, it will complete that. And this also works for commands. I'd like you to know about it just because I don't, it's annoying to see people in office hours who are wasting so much time you could be saving.